This is Wink Martindale, and you're listening to Tupelo Tom and Big Lou Talkin'.
I'm Tupelo Tom.
And I'm Big Lou.
And we're talking.
Man, we've got that thing down, bro. Only took us about a year, but yeah.
Well, we've got it down. Not only that, but to hear our introduction was pretty special, too.
Wink Martindale. Come on. That's just one of the coolest things ever.
Now, we, you know, we'll be paying him for the next 25 years, his talent fee, but it's luckily taken out by our subscription base of all the people who pay. Wait a minute. This is free. What did
this
we
is
do?
Free.
We came up with a bad deal. Jeff, this is a little special edition of talking with Tupelo Tom and Big Lou, because we're looking at something very special happening right now in Las Vegas. That is Daniel Durston, our buddy, who is appearing at the Westgate Hotel in an Elvis show. And he's been going for a few days. It's going to be going through August through September. And in the course of discussing Daniel, and he's going to be coming up later in the show, we started talking about his appearance there at the Westgate. And, of course, the Westgate, formerly the Hilton, formerly the International Hotel. And it's got me to thinking, you know, there's a lot of new Elvis fans entering the Elvis world. And instead of me going to a bunch of books to do research on it, or Jeff yourself, I thought, well, let's get one of the experts that's out there in the Elvis world. That would be John Daly, the owner-operator of the Elvis Presley Boulevard Pawn Shop, who knows a lot of history about Elvis, and especially those years at the International. So we welcome to the show, for the first time, but not the last, I'm sure, Mr. John Daly. Good afternoon, good morning, good night.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Well, we're excited to have you here. And like I said, I know you know a lot about the International and the history of that. But first of all, tell people about you. Like, how did the elevator story of John Daly entering the Elvis world and doing what it is that you do?
My first interaction with Elvis was in Myrtle Beach, and at a wax museum. I was on a family vacation, and so I saw Elvis before I ever heard Elvis. And as a child, I was kind of taken back by his Aloha from Hawaii suit, as I had never seen anyone ever dressed like that in my life. And I thought, that guy's got to be pretty cool.
That's great.
And it proved right.
It proved to be, I think, more than myself thinks that at this point.
Now, a lot of us who grew up in the Elvis era, when Elvis was alive, Elvis was one of the best merchandised performers, I guess, in history. And that a lot of that reason due to Colonel Parker. And there's a lot of thought on Colonel Parker, you know, positive and negative. My explanation has always been Elvis and the Colonel are kind of they're threads that form a tapestry. And if you pull a thread out, the whole thing falls apart.
Right.
What impact did – what negative, positive did Colonel have on Elvis's career? No one can really say. So it's kind of a moot argument. It was what it was. And I know you yourself have kind of studied Colonel and the way he managed Elvis, and you know enough about showbiz history to know that this stage of Elvis's life in 1969 was a tremendous chance that Elvis and the Colonel took in going from what had been a movie career. That TV special in December of 68, the American Sound Sessions in January that gave us Suspicious Minds and Don't Cry Daddy and Kentucky Rain in the Ghetto, and then opening in Vegas in summer of 1969 at what could have been any result, but ended up launching the next phase of Elvis's career.
It was a big gamble, and luckily the Colonel was smart enough to realize that it being a new building – to have Barbra Streisand open, which a lot of people don't realize. And so by the time that Elvis opened on July 31st, 1969, all the bugs and kinks had been worked out. And so his engagement from July into August of 1969, the shows went off without a hitch.
And the part of Vegas there that was happening in 1969, it was built by Kurt Krikorian, mm-hmm. Who was a rich investment guy, but it was built not on the strip, not in downtown Vegas at the time. It was kind of built all out to itself and was the largest showroom in Vegas at the time. What was Vegas like pre-Elvis? Because Vegas goes through phases mm-hmm. with what's in, and Vegas had still scene in the 60s, you know, Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin were still performing there.
Yeah, so you would have had a lot of the Rat Pack. You would have had a lot of, like, Jack Jones, you know, Engelbert Humperdinck, you know, was Tom Jones. Elvis really put Las Vegas on the map. It was an entertainment city, but Elvis Presley made it the entertainment capital of the world. And so they used him as a drawing card to pull people in. Even they in 75 and 76, they had the shows were called the pre-holiday Jubilee. And that was because in December, Vegas was dead. So if Vegas is dead in December, what do? You bring in Elvis Presley, and the city is abuzz because Elvis Presley is in town. So
yeah,
he made Las Vegas. And he made it a beacon for entertainment. And he basically was the guy that started the residencies out there. And so the residencies that you see of Adele and current day artists now began with Elvis Presley and Colonel Parker.
And what was it about this offer? I'm sure there were a lot of hotels that Colonel could have gone to talk to. What was it about Kurt Krikorian and the at the time, what was the International? What was it about that appealed to Colonel?
It really had to be the fact that it was the biggest hotel, you know, and the largest stage at that particular point. You know, after the success of the 68 comeback, it was they were planning tours and they planned Vegas. And so you wouldn't want to be at, let's say, the Sands or something like that, because Elvis Presley was at the International. And then after the International, he went to do the Astrodome. So it was more or less the demand is here. So we might as well go ahead and use the biggest facility that we can put him in because the demand is so strong, because people hadn't seen him other than in his movies for, you know, 7 or 8 years. So it got to the point where everyone wanted to see Elvis Presley, and you had to have a big venue for that.
And what is now such a famous era of Elvis's career, in that summer of 1969, like you said, Elvis had not been on stage for 7 or 8 years, and it was still at the time when he was doing live shows, kind of the same show he'd been doing in the 50s with, you know, 3 or 4 guys behind him, the Jordanaires over on one side and him banging on guitar in front. And this show in Vegas was slick and polished and
right,
ready to go. And he basically put it all together. Colonel kind of stayed out of that part of his career.
Right. The Colonel never really got involved with who Elvis Presley wanted as the musicians. That was solely left up to Elvis on who he wanted. And did Elvis always get everyone he wanted? No. But for the most part, you know, when the call came in, you know, for the Imperials to join on board, the Sweet Inspirations, and James Burton was really kind of heavily influenced Elvis on who he thought would be good, you know, with all of that. But yes, the large orchestrations and the kettle drums and, you know, all of that. That was all Elvis. The sound in his head is what comes out on the records. That was all him.
And we really hear that in the releases that have come out since 1977. Listening to Elvis in the studio, basically producing himself, telling the guys what he wants, and we see that, and that's the way it is. A concert film from 1970, where he's already got a few Vegas engagements under his belt, but he's really shaping what the show's going to be, how he's going to present himself on stage, how the songs are going to be arranged. He really did kind of work on all that himself. Take me through if you and I were and Big Lou were heading to Vegas in August of 1969. What would that have been like? Would we have gotten tickets ahead of time? Would we have gotten to the hotel and somehow talked to somebody somewhere, grease some palms, maybe Vegas style?
Yes.
How would we have gotten into the showroom, and how would we have gotten a good seat?
So July 31st, 1969 is the magical date. That was the press was there, the critics were there, and that was the celebrities were there. That wasn't open to the fans. The first fan show was August 1st of 1969. Now, there wasn't tickets per se for the engagements until 1976. Isn't that the craziest thing?
Wow.
So Elvis, 1969 to 1975, there were zero Elvis Presley tickets. 76 was the first year that they did them. So like it was basically first come, first serve. You would have had a reservation. So you would have called in and said, you know, how you wanted to, which shows that you wanted to go to. And so you would have had basically done your reservation, and then you would have paid for your show to go to. Now, when it came to the seating, that was very tricky because it was first come, first serve. People lined up early. And then there was a guy named Emilio who was the maitre d'. And so Emilio was the guy who seated you. So if you gave him a $5 tip, you probably would have been ushered directly to the balcony. If you gave him a $50 or $100 tip, well, let's reconsider some things now. Maybe we could get a booth or something down front. So you reserved your ticket to the show, but your tip is what allocated where your seat was.
Wow, Emilio, lucky guy.
Big Lou, I'll take care of the suite at the International. You tip Emilio, and we'll call Emilio. It even. Yeah, Emilio must have loved it when Elvis was in town.
There's photos of Emilio with Elvis, and it was well known. As a matter of fact, if you watch, That's the Way It Is. He's in it. He's the guy with the glasses. Yeah. Got an accent to him. That is Emilio. Yeah. He was the master maitre d' of the International showroom.
So basically, the short term is the more you tip, the closer you get. You just keep going down. Just keep peeling off 20s.
I've had fans tell me that they spent $20 to get into the show, and they would spend $50 or $100 for their seat. And that's why they have only gone to one. It was a big sacrifice from what I understand from the original fans, because they knew they had to tip well. Sometimes they would get in and they would tip less and they would get a cheap seat. But for the most part, most of the fans paid up for it, went to fewer shows and got better seats is what most of the fans did.
And that's one of the things you hear in Las Vegas, especially from even performers today. They really do want their true fans up toward the front. They don't want to see people having dinner and people that are there because they got comped into the show. They really want their fans up close. And I would think Elvis was probably the same way.
Yeah, he was. Absolutely. He wanted the fans to be down front. And a little side note to that, even, you know, because all the pretty girls were down front, all the fans. And when he gave the kisses out, he even mentioned, you know, I always look at the guy to make sure he smiles before I kiss him. So he wanted them down front.
Yeah. And I've always heard the legend in Vegas that when you go to a show in Vegas, they are rigidly timed because they don't want you spending a lot of time in the showroom. Elvis is a draw to get people into Vegas, but you're also coming to Vegas for another reason, and that's what built the hotel.
Yeah, that was definitely surrounded the gambling aspect of it. And Elvis would say on a few occasions, you know, I'm sure they're out there saying, I wish the hell he'd get these people out of here. But, you know, but Elvis Presley ran his show, and if he wanted to throw a few songs in or stay on an extra 10 minutes, nobody was going to tell him otherwise.
Yeah. In the movie Elvis, the Baz Luhrmann film, Austin Butler plays Elvis. I know the film, kind of the overarch of the movie story-wise is the International kind of becomes a character in there, because we keep going back and forth in time in the movie, especially to Vegas and the International. What were your thoughts on the film and how it treated this era of Elvis's life? Understanding, as I hope fans understand, a 2.5-hour movie is not going to tell a 42-year life.
I would say that it was entertaining. I wouldn't say it was necessarily factual. If you want to be a big nerd about this and break it down, 69 and 70 was the International. 71, it was the International Hilton. 72, it was the Las Vegas Hilton, all the way through till 76, when he did his last show in December of 76. So it had a few name changes along the way, very minor things. And a lot of times, if you look at menus or banners and such, you can actually date based on what the verbiage is that's on there. But to answer your question about the movie, it captured the excitement of what was going on. But, you know, by, you know, 1974, 75, it wasn't the International. It was the Las Vegas Hilton at that point.
Yeah. And I, being a movie nerd and an Elvis nerd, I thought, you know what, if they had changed it, there'd have to be a line of dialogue like, oh, Kirk sold the hotel to Baron Hilton.
Right.
Oh, well, it's going to have to be the Hilton now, boys. And that explains, you know, and it's just, there's just not that kind of time. It's kind of like the reason that a lot of the Memphis Mafia are not in the movie. They're represented by a few guys, but because it's just, it's not really adding to the story. It's just, it's factually correct. But again, this is not a documentary. It's a movie about telling a story. Now, one part of Elvis in Vegas, and if you go back and you see any of these photos, and Jeff, I know you're a collector. My wife, a couple of years ago, a year or so ago, knows I love the Elvis Vegas era, and she got with John for our anniversary, and John put together an international box of stuff for me that she got me for my birthday, and it really drove home the point that Elvis was marketed in Vegas, as well as any product is marketed nationally. Everything in Vegas, at the Hilton especially, had Elvis's name on it. I mean, what you put together, things I didn't even know existed or would have been Elvis associated, like playing cards or dice or menus, all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there was a lot of generic things regarding the property itself. But yes, there was a lot. There was hound dogs. There was posters, even the bags had Elvis Presley's name on it. And what's really fun is there are things that you can get from that time period that were sold. And then you start getting into things, you know, like banners and that sort of thing, the circular medallions and things that were not sold. So I have in my collection things that were there, but were never priced. They just walked out the door one day under his arm. So,
and I have in my collection one of those banners John's talking about, and it's beautiful. It's a red. Well, we're not on camera, but it's RCA Records, and it's a beautiful banner that was hanging from the ceiling.
That was never sold. That just walked out the door. It wasn't by me. I never saw Elvis. So. but yeah, so that's kind of the separation of the things that the Colonel had made up. Postcards were a really big thing. They sold his albums out there. They sold Madison Square Garden out there. They had Having Fun with Elvis on Stage was being sold out there. So it really was a quite the mecca of merchandise at the merchandise table. They were very in depth with what they had. The big hound dogs were a whole $25 back then. And so they really expanded into the tab pins and everything. It was what now really, what was going on then is what gives me a job now, because those items are so hot, everyone's looking for them. And so it keeps me working to find those things. So thank you to the Colonel and thank you to Elvis for all of the merchandise, because I have a job now 50 years later because of it.
It's a part of history that would be lost. I mean, like you said, a lot of those things were not made to be sold. They were made to promote and were somewhat expendable, but because Elvis's name is on them, they become, you know, as the guy says in Raiders, Jeff, you know, it's just an ordinary watch to the two of us, but put it in the ground for 2,000 years, it becomes a priceless relic.
Right.
You know, now, John, the International, like you said, Elvis played there last in 1976, and the Hilton went on, you know, after Elvis. And tell us a little bit about the hotel in the years following that, because all of Vegas is cyclical. Things come in, they stay there for a while, they go out, things fall into fashion, out of fashion. Luckily for us, I mean, as we are doing this interview, they're gutting out and tearing down the Mirage Hotel, the one with the volcano that's about 25 years old. They tore down the Tropicana, which was about 50 years old. A few years ago, they took the Riviera to the ground. I mean, there's a lot of Vegas history that, as historic as it is and how cool as it is, they want to get their money out of that square footage. So the hotel goes and they build something else. Luckily for us, the International is still there. What can we see if we go there today that would have been around during Elvis's reign?
Look for the door handles that you are in the shape of an H for the Hilton. And back behind the stage, there's actually original orange signs that date back to the 1969-1970 International. They're there. They're hidden, but they are still there. I guess a lot of the ornate glass that's, you know, in the casino, I think a lot of that was originally there. The showroom has unfortunately gone through a lot of changes. The stage was altered and the booths have been taken out and such. But the central tower in the middle, I mean, that was the original tower from 69. It's been built onto and added to. But there are still little gems that if you go and you know what you're looking for, you will still see things that date back to the time period of Elvis. You very well could see a sign that Elvis Presley himself had read in 1969.
And it's cool. The elevator backstage.
Yes.
It's the exact same. It smells like 1969. It's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
It smells like Dick Grobe just got off smoking cigarettes.
That's exactly what it smells. And now, yeah. John, what's the restaurant that was there that's still there?
Oh, that's Benihana.
Yeah,
Benihana is there's footage of photos of Benihana being added, and you can see the Elvis banners and the marquees and all of that. Benihana has been there, I think somewhere around like 1970 or 71. It's pretty old. It's been there a long time.
And I can verify that because there was one year that Jerry Schilling and I were out at an event at the hotel. And he and I were walking around the hotel, and we went down that side hallway where Benihana's is. Mm-hmm. We were headed to the steakhouse, but as soon as we got close to Benihana's, Jerry was like, I can't believe this is still here. And we went into Benihana's and had a cocktail because he remembered it. And he said it basically, in his mind, had not changed at all from what it had been back in the day. So
something else, too, that happened at the Las Vegas Hilton, and a lot of people don't realize this, but they're the first – I'm going to go out on a limb on this. I'm going to say the very first Elvis Presley festival, and I know y'all's ears has perked up, was in 1978 at the Las Vegas Hilton. It was called Always Elvis. And that's when they had the unveiling of the statue. Vernon Presley was in attendance. Priscilla Presley was in attendance. They had jumpsuits. They had his cars. And they did an exhibit there in September of 1978. So 76, December of 76 was Elvis's last live performance there, December 12th. But then in September of 78, in my opinion, would be the very first Elvis Presley festival.
I think 13 months later, I would say that you're probably right. Now, there's also a part of the hotel. And by the way, that statue's still there in the lobby as you come in People put lays on it and get their photos. Elvis is still within the walls of the Hilton, which is now the Westgate. To give proper due, the Westgate Hotel. But upstairs, Elvis spent – he would be in there because his schedule was pretty much 30 days in a row, no off days.
Yeah. Early on, they would do two shows a day. And then by 75 and 76, he would actually be there for 12. So, 10, because the last engagement was December the 2nd through December the 12th. And they were single shows. So he eventually got down to doing one show per night. And a lot of times people think, you know, oh, he did these, you know, two shows a day. But you also have to understand that his shows were 1 hour. So he wasn't doing 2 and 3 hour shows. They were 1 hour blocks. And then he would do usually a dinner show and a midnight show. Yeah. That was like 70, 71. But then it started to kind of scale back later on.
And being at the hotel for that length of time, especially in the early days, he pretty much stayed upstairs in the suite. When you look at the hotel, that very top center little turret of windows, that was Elvis's suite upstairs. And I know it's also over the years gone through some renovation, but a lot of great stories in the Elvis world. Any new fans, you know, listen out for any stories having to do with Elvis up in the suite in Las Vegas, because a lot of adventures happened in that suite upstairs.
Yeah, that was basically his home away from home. He didn't really venture out much in Las Vegas when he was there. There's an interview I saw recently with Tom Jones where he said that he remembered Elvis staying on for a few weeks to see Tom. That probably was 74, as I'm recalling some photos. But he probably had access to the suite, I would anticipate, even though he was probably not the headliner, but he still probably would have had access up there.
Yeah, nobody's going to tell the next person that they need Elvis is, you know, you need to go, Mr. Presley. Barry Manilow's here. Now, there was one story Jerry told me, and Alex Mitchell, our producer, will let me know if I can't remember, and you may remember, if this was in the Jerry episode of Talking that we did a few months back. But I just remember, and it's a story, I think it's in Jerry's book, Elvis is up in the suite and he's got a telescope and he's looking out over Las Vegas and he sees a car dealership across the way. You know, it's a telescope, so it could be a pretty long way away. And he says, Jerry, go get me some cars. And Jerry shows up at this place and the guy doesn't believe it. And he says, how do you know about it? And he said, oh, I'm here for Elvis Presley. He's watching us right now. And Elvis was in the suite looking out of the telescope.
And Tom, you know who was with him? And no. John knows this because we heard the story from him. Joe Mascalo was in Elvis's suite at the time. And Elvis goes, hey, Joe, look, that he looked through that telescope at the car dealership. And Joe told us that story separately, me and John.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a pretty good one, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's just, you know, you entertain yourself when you're cooped up that long, having to do a couple of shows in the desert, because, you know.
A side note to that, Joe, I guess part of the deal was he told Jerry how many cars to buy. And then he said, but they got to be detailed and in front of the hotel in like, I don't know, an hour or something like that. Suddenly all these guys come running out detailing the cars real fast and he could see it through the telescope. Well, that's just so classic Elvis, you know.
Yeah, you can see Jerry going, this one or this one? And Elvis like, that one. Dude, okay, that one over there. Well, John, it's been great having you on. Like, I wanted you on to give us a little history of the international, but I want to have you back on another episode to talk really about the collectibles of Elvis. There's a world of Elvis collectibles out there. I remember there used to be back in the 80s, large paperback books published of, you know, Elvis collectibles that really now you wouldn't be able to pick up the volume if they printed it as on paper, because there's so much over the years, and, you know, almost 50 years of collectibles since Elvis has been gone. What is the thing that is out there that you know is out there that you want desperately, but you just don't know where it is or how to get it or what? What's that item?
Actually, it happened this week.
What? Really?
Yeah, it happened this week. I had a gentleman reach out who is a reseller in Texas, and he emailed me and said, I've got these Elvis Presley cufflinks. Okay, well, that could be an Elvis Presley Enterprise thing or anything. So long story short, they're the ones from 1956. They say Elvis Presley Enterprise is 1956 on the back of them. I knew these existed because I have a booklet from 1956 that talks about the merchandise, and it has a mention of cufflinks in it. But the tricky part was I wasn't really for sure if they were even made. I checked with several collectors. Nobody had ever seen them before. And so a guy in Texas dug them up. And they'll probably be in Memphis tomorrow when I get back.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my goodness. Well, this was a good timing on this then, you know? I got to tell you, John.
I'll send you all a picture of them. They're pretty spectacular. I can't wait to see them.
Oh, wow.
Please do. We'll put that on our Facebook page. And John, I, you know, of all of the stuff you got for me and that you put together for my wife to give to me, I think the items that are the International Hilton are the most special to me because they were so short-lived, and things like dice and playing cards are just so expendable in a casino.
Right.
And to have some things that are International Hilton is just very special.
Yeah, that's a great year. 71 in Vegas, that's a great year for merchandise.
And yeah. Tom, I've got a straw hat with the International band on it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and Bill Cherry wanted it. Sorry, Bill. Big Lou got it.
Yeah, I'm hoping Bill Cherry doesn't see this episode and of the faux pas that I have done on getting rid of that on him.
nobody mention anything to Bill if you see Bill. That's just our little secret. John, how do people, if people have collections of items, they got family members that have things and they don't want them anymore, or they've come into possession of Elvis items, how do they get in touch with you about perhaps you taking that collection off their hands? How do people get in touch with you?
They can call the shop at 901-949-1977. Gee, I wonder how I got that number.
First of all, I wanted to ask you that because that's on a big sign on your van that you drive around, and you've been here in Tupelo restocking relics a lot, and we've met up there. Tell me, who do you know at the post office? Who do you know at the phone company that you can get 1977, for goodness sake? Or can you give us a secret? Can you let that secret out even?
My secret is that my job before Elvis was 17 years at Verizon.
Oh.
So it's not what you know, it's who you know.
Spoken. Colonel Parker would be proud of you, my boy.
I think so. Or they can also email theelvispawnshop@gmail.com. I'm on social media as well. You can look up on Instagram and Facebook as well. Or you can just Google John Daly Elvis. I should come up as well.
Not John Daly Golfer, John Daly Elvis. Let's be very clear about that.
And yeah. I got to tell you, John just said something that I'm so proud of. You can Google Tom Brown and Elvis and stuff comes up. And I'm like, man, to be in that Google with Elvis, are you kidding? Isn't that cool? Yeah, Alex Mitchell, Elvis, you cool. Come up. It Jeff is. Lewis, Elvis, we all come it's up. It's great. Amazing.
It's awesome.
All right. Well, John Daly, you have set the stage perfectly for us. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to join a guy who's right there inside the walls of the hotel with a very special Elvis show, Daniel Durston. And now we kind of know the history of the building. So we're going to find out what's going on there now. Elvis is still in the building in Las Vegas. Big Lou, we'll be back.
Talk, and we know that you have a lot of options when it comes to your daily dose of papaya. So why not choose Queenie Wahine's papaya? It's rich in vitamins A, C, and E, as well as folate. This papaya really packs a punch. Forget that plum pudding, pink popcorn, and peach pie. It's the papaya you'll desire when Queenie Wahine passes by. That's right, Queenie Wahine's papaya is rated higher than pineapple, pumpkin, or poi, and it's sold at fine grocers nationwide. So reach for it today.
So, Daniel, I'm excited to have you on the show because all I've heard for the last few months is how excited Jeff is to have you on the show.
Yes.
And though I do not watch Big Brother and haven't seen it, I feel like I have because of Jeff, who I think now might actually be executive producing the show from the way he talks. But I'm excited to have you here, not only to hear about that, but to talk to you about something that every Elvis tribute artist and every Elvis fan, kind of the mecca of where they want to go in the world to just feel the vibe of Elvis, is the old International Hilton, now Westgate Hotel. And you've brought the jumpsuit back into the building, my friend.
Oh, yeah. It's crazy. It's very surreal for me, but it's super special. And we just started. So this is perfect timing to talk with you guys.
Well, tell me about that. How did this come to be to you know, that building has been there for years. It's kind of Barry Manilow's building now. But back in the day, Elvis ruled Vegas out of that building. And they finally decided, hey, you know, we should do this Elvis thing since there's a statue in the lobby.
Yeah. Well, I don't know how long they've been thinking about it. I've been obviously meeting everybody at the Westgate in the last 2 weeks, and they said they've been wanting something like this for a very long time, and the timing just happened to be now. I don't know how I got involved. I was reached out through the production company, and I don't know if they've seen Big Brother and they're like, well, he's in Vegas, or if they came to Legends or whatever that may be, because they're based out of Tennessee. So my manager got an email. He sent it to me, and I thought it was fake. I'm not even kidding. Yeah. I was like, I don't think my manager understands what this means. Like, he's not a big Elvis guy. He's just like, he represents me. So he's just like, hey, like the Westgate's reaching out. They want you. And I was like, that's not true. Like, I'm going to do some research. And so I looked up the production company. They put on the show Solo Motown that's been at the Westgate for 4 years or so now. And I've seen their, you know, billboards and stuff like that. So I was like, well, this is a legit company. Let me dive a little deeper. I think it took me about 24 hours of research to go, well, I'm going to say yes. Like,
yeah, really.
It wasn't April 1st. Okay, good.
And so once all the manager stuff happened, I was linked up directly within about 2 days. It was very fast. And I just remember thinking in our careers, all of us who are entertainers, it's like, well, my brother has a saying that he says, you're not there until you're there, because so many things can fall through. So many people could fib or whatever. So I just kept that in my head, like, well, I've had some great opportunities that fell through. So let's just take it easy, focus, do what you got to do, and like hope for the best. And it honestly wasn't until they announced it officially, the day press releases went out, that I felt, well, I guess I got a show to do. But that's not to say that they weren't very communicative and like very on top of it the whole time. Yeah. It was just myself, you know, artist doubt of like, who knows? We'll see. But yeah, so it felt very fast. And I can't believe the show. We're already 3 shows in. And it's just, it's surreal, as you can imagine, being there.
Well, for Elvis fans to, you know, they want to go to that building anyway. And now you've really given them something to enjoy. Tell me about the show. Like, how'd you put it together? What's in the show?
Yeah. So what's cool about DDM Productions from out from Pigeon Forge, Tennessee, they, from the very beginning, were super collaborative. They sent me about 27 songs or something that they wanted to do. The whole idea is we go through all the eras, that's including 50s movies, black leather, even into the If I Can Dream white suit. Somehow I'd make the change, and then into the white jumpsuit. And they sent me like 27 songs. And obviously throughout this career, as every Elvis does, every gig you learn like one extra new song. So my library has grown quite a bit in 7 years, and I knew every song but maybe four like by heart. So I was like, oh, this is great. And then the four didn't really work with my voice personally, and they were on top of, they're like, what's going to make you shine? How do you feel confident in this? Wow. And let's talk about changing the set list. And I was like, oh my gosh, like I come from musical theater where you can't change anything.
Yeah.
And then also in the ETA world, sometimes, you know, people send you a set list saying, this is what you're playing. Do you want the check or not? And it's like, I will learn all the songs. Yeah. And so what was cool was I already felt comfortable from the beginning. I said, how about we change this to this, because I feel stronger in my voice here. I said, my biggest request is that If I Can Dream is in the white suit. That's my number one of all things. And they're like, done. Like, they're so supportive. I've never met anybody like that in a producing aspect, you know? And so also going on stage as the artist, you kind of have this connection of ownership as well to the set list. So you do feel this sense of like, I helped put this together. This is also part of mine. And I think that shows in the show as far as comfortability and just owning it on stage type of thing. And so, yeah, it's 26 songs, I think.
Wow.
About 80 minutes right now, 85 minutes, depending on the audience and all stuff like that. Yeah. And it's a powerhouse. I always say the backstage quick changes are way more exciting than the onstage stuff.
Yeah, when you started
sideburns going on.
When you started going through those outfits, I thought, okay, well, that's, you got to stack those things in order, you know, to get ready. For you as an ETA Elvis tribute artist, how did you get started? What was it about Elvis? Because you said you were a musical theater guy. What was it about Elvis?
Yeah, so I grew up doing musical theater since I was 14 or so. I still love it. Hope to do more of it. And it was actually Million Dollar Quartet on Broadway in 2010 when I was like, wait, I would love to be on Broadway one day. And I think I could look and sound like Elvis. I think I could do Johnny Cash and with my height and all that. And so I really started studying Elvis a lot, and I wanted to get on the first national tour. It didn't happen. What's funny is this is my introduction to Elvis and the ETA world. So I auditioned for 6 years just trying to get the tour, right? Well, that first like year, I obviously was way too green now looking back. But I didn't get even a, I think I got one call back or something. And I was like, yeah, we'll see who the Elvis is. Like, as if I knew anything at the time. I go to the Pantages Theater in LA, which is basically our Broadway theater. And I go see Mil Nocturne, and it's Cody Slaughter. So I was like, oh, that's why I didn't get it. Okay. And then I started working even harder, going, if that's what they're looking for, let me. So that was like my true introduction to like the ETA world personally, was Cody Slaughter. So you can imagine me going, well, I got to try to aim for that. Like, if I want this to be any type of career. After 6 years of auditioning, I got the national tour Mil Nocturne for 3 years. And towards the end of that, when I knew it was kind of like my time to leave, I actually got a call from Legends in Vegas. And they said, we have 10 days. We want you to take over for Cody Slaughter's spot. And can you be here? And I was like, well, I'm not on the tour anymore. I'll be there in 10 days. I live in LA. Sounds good to me. And that was my true stripes of becoming an ETA, which I understand now is unreal, not normal. And that's not to say that I didn't appreciate it at the time, but now it's like, oh my God, I like learned my way, paved my way through Legends and Concert. How unreal is that? And they were supportive, and now it's all brought me here.
And like you said, being a musical theater person, you're used to the structure of a show like a Million Dollar Quartet, where a lot of ETAs who are performers and not musical theater people, they lean into the spontaneity of being a live show, live concert with fans and scarves and things. So at least your first opportunity is in that music. It's within the guardrails of the musical theater, but it's Elvis. So it's right. Kind of both your strengths there together.
Yeah. Or at least I learned later on that I was like, wait, and you're playing live instrument on stage at Million Dollar Quartet. So there's so many things that came together where I was like, wow, this is like unreal. It actually made sense for my career and my path at the time. And I never thought I'd be an ETA ever. Like, it was just, I was a theater kid trying to, you know, succeed in that. And it just led me here. And it's obviously a beautiful way to enter it all and without expectations. And, but I just come from a very strong work ethic background from my family and stuff. So I think that helps in the sense of, well, I want to try to be the best, even if I'm not going to be. I will try everything I can to make sense of this and not only make my family proud, myself, but also Elvis fans, because that is huge. Like, it is the hardest hurdle, I think, you know, because there's so many fans and there's so many different versions of Elvis in people's minds and memories. So you just got to try your best and just go. And I haven't stopped. I still don't think I'm at any platform. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's like, well, I still got to reach it, whatever, wherever that's at. I just try to, you know, especially with this show, I'm still trying to work out everything I can.
And like you said, as you were coming into it, being green, not knowing the ETA world that kind of grew up over the last 15, 20 years. I think about Jeff, how you fell into it. What's the story you tell about seeing the guys on stage and they just had such great hair and you just thought, I can't do this.
Yeah, you know, so I was a singer songwriter in Nashville. I was a session singer and I was out there for 25 years. And then we put together this band called the Hillbilly Bastards and we dressed like idiots. And it was a heck of a band, but we toured all the colleges in the Southeastern Conference and all around there. Cause I lived in Nashville. And my agent called one day, our booking agent, said, hey, do you still do your Elvis stuff? Cause you know, I was a big Elvis fan. And in Nashville, we'd do fundraisers for dog rescue, and I wouldn't dress like Elvis, but we'd do an Elvis show, right? And so I was laughing like most people do. What do you mean, like those weirdos that dress up? Yeah, that's what everybody thinks. And so I went to the Ultimate in 2010. I thought, well, I'll watch it. And he goes, no, yeah, there's these guys are really good. And, you know, Cody Slaughter was one of the first guys that walked out. And I always talk about when I saw Bill Cherry. I saw Elvis in 1977. Wow. And when Bill Cherry walked out, I go, that was it. I was 10 years old all over again. And I made a comment. I said, yeah, man, I know I can probably sing with all of them, but, man, they all have great hair. And this lady in front of me goes, honey, they all wearing wigs. I couldn't believe it. So, and I bet another transition, because I know you mainly do in the theater, but when you, say, for example, performed in Tupelo and all that, the fan base is probably nothing like you expected. That was what shocked me, was the passion of the fans and the seriousness of the guys that have committed to being an Elvis tribute artist. They're encyclopedias of Elvis. And I thought I knew everything about Elvis. I wasn't even a kindergartner at Elvis High School. I mean, you know, I learned so much from the guys. It's been a great ride.
Yeah, it's pretty insane, like, what really goes into it, not just ETAs, but the fans themselves who keep it alive. And that's outside of just Elvis himself. Obviously, the ETA world is another entity within that. And, you know, experiencing Tupelo last year, last competition, was unreal. Like, the amount of love I got, and I was new, I'm pretty new to the ETA world as far as competitions go. People already, like, knew me and stuff. And I was like, wait, what? How? Like, now I know. They do their research. They know what they're doing. And they're like, some I met were like, I don't know who you are. And I go, okay. You know what I mean? And, but I get it now because that's their world that I'm entering type of thing with the fans and stuff. So, but thanks to them, you know, they're keeping all this alive. And I remember you guys talking about quite a bit on this podcast. I'm a big listener.
All right.
But I think, Daniel, you told me you listened all the way out from California to Tupelo, didn't you?
Yeah. So I drove from California to Tupelo last year, and that's when I discovered your podcast. And I was like, wait, if they're going to be there and I'm going to Tupelo, I got to dive in. And I listened to every episode because that was a 3-day drive. So, wow. But yeah, I love you guys pointing out on the podcast that the fans are what are keeping it alive, you know, and it's super special how much they really do care.
Yeah. It's one of those things that when you take the stage, if the fans don't know you, if you take the stage with respect, that you've done your homework, that you're being true to Elvis, you can be yourself and they will totally open their arms and embrace you because they feel your love for Elvis, because it's all about respect. And I tell people this all the time who are not people who attend the festivals and things, that they're never Elvis on stage. They're not in character as Elvis. It's just, it's a recreation and it's a feeling that maybe you're going to feel what it was like to see Elvis just for a second or two. Because nobody pretends to be Elvis and nobody has that. And it's tough to find a person like yourself. There are very few who can do all the eras.
Oh, thank you.
You know, so I'm happy that you're doing that in the Vegas show, that you're touching all the eras and that you're giving them that experience. Because I'm sure you've noticed this over the last few years. The fans are actually getting younger.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. After the movie, especially.
Oh, yeah. It's unreal.
So you're bringing in, you know, you're bringing in Big Brother fans, you're bringing in new fans, you're bringing in people that want entertainment. And I, like I said, I just think it's great that they walk into that building now and there's a poster that says, oh my gosh, we can see an Elvis show here at the Westgate.
And once they see it, they're like me when I go, oh no, this is like real. This is fantastic. And of course, we interviewed with the great honor and fortune of interviewing Jerry Schilling, and Jerry always tells Tom, what does he say, Tom, about Elvis?
Oh yeah, bring the young people to Elvis and he'll take care of the rest. He's been doing it since 1954.
Yup.
Yeah.
Isn't that love great? That.
And here's what's funny. Daniel comes from, he wasn't originally an Elvis tribute artist. He was a Blink. Is it 182?
I mean,
I'm a hillbilly singer. I don't know. And you went from doing that music. That has to, and you think at first that's quite a big jump, but Elvis in kind of his own right was a rebellious punk rocker as well for that era.
Yeah. I honestly do think Elvis was the first punk rock kid of all time. And like, you're going to get hardcore punk kids like freaking out about that, but I'm a punk kid at heart. And once I did my research on Elvis many years ago, doing Million Dollar Quartet from his early days, I mean, that is punk rock. Like, everything he did was insane. Yeah. And I even so much read, I forget what book it was, that there was one time where Elvis literally, like, in the 50s, destroyed an acoustic guitar on stage. And I was like, I literally was like, wait, what? And this is while I was, like, writing the Blink-182 musical. I was like, this is unreal. I've never heard of that in my life. But it's I got to find out what book, but it's a legit book. I remember researching, like, who's this author? Like, who's some people making this up, you know? But I was like, that's insane. But yeah, I'm a huge Blink fan. I'm a punk rock kid. I grew up playing guitar my whole life. And yeah, somehow it really does all cross together. I really do think.
Daniel, where did you grow up?
Ontario, California. Okay. So it's about an hour east of Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And then just, I worked at like Disneyland. So I lived in Anaheim, California. I gigged in LA as a musician for a few years. So I lived in Studio City, North Hollywood in LA. And then And then I toured for 12 years of my life as a musician for musicals and different rock bands like the Vans Warped Tour and stuff like that. And then once I got Million Dollar Quartet, that was the last 2 to 3 years of touring of my life. And once I got Legends in Concert in Vegas, that's when I was essentially, quote unquote, settled down other than doing fly dates, you know?
Yeah. I always hear about living in Vegas is different than vacationing in Vegas.
It is. It's actually way better than you think. Like my house is like, it's near the strip, but it's actually, it feels so secluded. And you don't go to the strip unless you're working or let's say family's here. I want to make sure they have a good experience or whatever. But I always go to downtown Fremont, which is like the best part of Vegas other than the Westgate. But
right.
But yeah, it's always good to do like one show on the strip and then go to downtown. Mm-hmm. But people think if you live here, you gamble, you drink. Yes, we do. But but it's not, that's not your life. You have to understand if I'm going to live here, that's not what I'm doing. I'll do it once a month. And I was surprised, as dumb as it sounds, that there's a Target here. There's a grocery store. Yeah. There's things to do.
It's an actual city.
I was like, wait, if you 10 minutes off the strip, there's a whole life. It's actually unreal because it looks like desert, but it's tons of people who live here. But I love it. I love it here.
Anytime I visit a city, I try to go where I see a lot of police cars parked because I know that's probably good food in that restaurant if there's like a lot of police cars outside. And so you're a theater person. You get into music. You're doing all this with music. When does reality television and how does reality television enter your life?
I forgot I did that sometimes. So Big Brother is one of the first reality shows of all time, along with Real World and I think maybe Survivor. But back in 2000, 2001, I saw the first season and I was like obsessed with it. I was like 13, 14 or whatever.
Richard Hatch, right?
There you go. Survivor.
Yeah, that's the only season of any reality show I watched. I was like, how can it get better than this? This guy is so evil. And he was so good.
And those were kind of the best seasons of all time. So you're not wrong.
The templates, for what follows. Yeah.
So since then, I loved the show. And once I got, I was like, oh, old enough or whatever. I was like, I want to audition for Big Brother. For some reason, that show, I found more interest in that show than any other one. And I auditioned for 10 years straight every year.
Wow.
You could tell I'm persistent about these auditions.
I was just about to say, you are persistent,
when
man.
I want something, I'm like, hey, I can't die before this happens. And so with Big Brother, I auditioned every year, whether it's in person or on video, and I had multiple callbacks. So I was like, there's something going on here, so let me just stick with it. I think moving to Vegas and becoming an ETA only helped this my backstory type of thing. And it was the year that I officially moved to Vegas, right after the year after COVID or whatever. That I got pushed through multiple rounds. And for those who may be interested, the audition process for Big Brother for me personally was 4 months long. And I did probably 10 callbacks. And towards the end, you go through psych tests, you do medical tests. Like, it's so intense that you get to a point where you go, I just don't care anymore. Like, which means it's a job. It's probably going to work out. And so it was so stressful, especially because we're coming off of COVID. So it's very like, if you even have a strain in you, you're not going on. And it's like, all right, like I get it, but it was intense. And so anyway, that's my long winded story of after 10 years of just really wanting to get on it. It worked out. And truly one of my life goals, it was like top three that I need to do this in my life, even if I'm 50, 60 doing it. And it's nice to kind of get that checked off the list this early on for multiple reasons. But it was a dream come true, and I'm so proud of it, and I'm so happy that it all happened.
Well, you know, I've got a ton of questions about that, but which was the bigger shock? This is a dumb question, but I think my answer might be surprising, but which is the bigger shock, that you're playing the Westgate doing an Elvis show or that you got on Big Brother? You know?
Oh, there's
those are pretty two big accomplishments there.
It's crazy. I would say Westgate. And I think that's only because there was no part of my brain 15 years ago thinking that I would portray Elvis ever in any aspect. And then let alone be at the Westgate where he lived and performed. So that's crazy. Big Brother to me seemed more tangible. And that's why I was like so after it. And Westgate came out of nowhere. And so, Westgate, I think, so I'm still, actually I'm in that like weird little fog of like, this is crazy. Like, that's how I was with Big Brother, which was actually 2 years ago today. I was in sequester for Big Brother, which means you're trapped. I can't say too much, but you're alone in a room for a while until you even enter the TV show. So, but when you're alone in that room, you're just like, how is this really happening? Like all that type of stuff, even though you're there, you know? But yeah, so I'm in that weird little phase, and I hope with Westgate, it doesn't ever go away. And I don't think it will, because it's too special.
The Big Brother, is that, I remember going when I lived in LA, and where I would go back to LA on business. I would always go to Farmer's Market, and it's by CBS TV City there. Is Big Brother, is it the sequester there at CBS? Is that where the...
It's not at CBS, and that's as much as I could say now.
Okay.
Yeah, he's under a gag order till September. Now,
well, it's there or Radford. That's all I could probably Google it, but I won't get you in trouble.
So the actual show is shot at Radford,
okay,
the TV show. I wasn't there for sequester, is like... You're off site.
Yeah, that's
it's like super secretive, because once fans find out, they'll actually show up and try to.
Compare it to, it's like the warehouses for Graceland. No one knows where they are.
Yeah,
and they took me to them, and I looked down the whole way because I didn't even want to know where they were, because I said, if I'm ever tortured, I don't want to know where these warehouses are. So I just I was in the car with my head down like this. So
for Big Brother, we're blindfolded a lot when we're being driven somewhere.
Wow.
So that's how much they. Though I know LA.
Yeah.
So I understand once I got off the show, I was like, oh, now I know where I was, what happened. Yeah, yeah. But not everyone's from the LA area, so they don't know.
Yeah.
They're from, you know, a whole different state. But a lot of time, if we're being driven before or after the show, it's over, it's fine. But before the show, to interviews, pre-interviews, all this stuff, you're blindfolded every time you get in the car. And that's how intense they are. It's very strict. It's crazy.
Now, I notice you've mentioned several times about your research, whether it's researching the author of that book or researching Elvis or whatever. Does that come from the actor experience, or are you just normally that kind of person that I want to know everything about this?
I think it might be partly like in my DNA, just from my parents and how I was raised, and just it might be in my blood. But I do think it really does stem from acting. Because once I started musical theater when I was 13, 14, I don't know what that was. It was just like natural to be like, well, if I'm the ensemble member in Grease, why is he in this gang? Why is he, you know what I mean? Like, why is he a T-Bird? Yeah. And I was like 13, like, who does that? But
A little Meisner before you knew it, a little Meisner technique.
And that's when I was just ensemble. And then once I got a couple lead characters in like Les Miserables and then other things, I was like, well, I'm going to read the book. Like, and that's before the big movie came out. So I was like, I'm going to read the whole book, and then I'm going to study what this character would have done and all that stuff. So it definitely comes from my musical theater background of wanting to emulate a feeling and an experience from behind. And to me, it's all about what's in that person's head that you're experiencing. Everything else is like the practice of it. Mm-hmm. And little did I know that would go right into Elvis Presley, where it's like, yeah, we could sing Return to Sender. Everyone's going to know what it is. But I think it's what you're feeling and thinking and what the experience behind it that people feel, even though they'll never know what that really is, that energy in the room, you know?
All those years of wanting to do Big Brother and auditioning for it over the years, year in, year out, I'm sure you watched it. How much of a calculated, if you can talk about this, of a calculated idea did you have of how you wanted to play? What is essentially the game of Big Brother?
Yeah, I had it all written down. I had everything planned out. Everything almost went exact to plan, believe it or not.
Oh.
And if you watch the show, you'll be like, how is that exact to plan? But there's some things I can't say about the show that that was working against me and I had no power. But on September 28th, I'll tell you everything.
I cannot wait. So, hey, what is the worst thing about Big Brother that you can tell us about? Like, I know people that were on Survivor and they go, it is so boring.
Oh yeah,
like you just sit there, and then 1 hour a week you do something or whatever. What was that like with Big Brother? Is it being in the house? Was it getting along with everybody? What was that? The worst part about it?
I actually like the boring stuff a little bit because my mind works a mile a minute, and when I'm at home, I go, well, if I'm awake, I'm gonna be working on something, and so I needed something to say, hey, just chill. Like this is your job now. Shut up. Like. And so I was actually way more relaxed in that house, believe it or not. But I think the worst part would be you're essentially, you are friends with everybody. You, everyone on our season, believe it or not, got along, and they just obviously showed the 2 minutes where someone doesn't get along.
Yeah.
But that's natural, human stuff. But in the house, we all eat together. We all essentially sleep in the same rooms. So you do live together, and we're, none of us were jerks. Like, it was like, oh, I can't even be around that person type of thing. But the worst part would be there's four rooms, I think, for 16 people. And whatever room you're in, you feel some sense of comfortability and some sense of like, oh, like I got this figured out. We're good. I'm going to the top, baby. And as soon as you leave the room, even though my best friends are in that room, your mind goes, they hate me. They're working against me. And how do I figure this out? And how do I get all of them out? Like,
wow.
And you know that they're thinking that too. And it's so weird because 80% of it is not real. Like in your heads, I'm saying. So like, yeah, my best friend Terrence was in that room, but he would never vote me out. But yet I'm thinking, what if he did? So your mind's playing games on you. And that's the whole point of the social experiment, which is why I'm a fan of the show. But when you're living it, you walk into the kitchen and there's two people by the microwave, just like very close talking. Yeah. And it's your best friend. It's like your alliance.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, they're talking about me. And it's like, no, they're not, dude. Like
Tom and I were backstage in Tupelo and we were kind of just talking low. And somebody walked by and go, oh, something's up.
Yeah. No,
and one of my best friends, Greg, every girl I ever dated hated him because he'd walk up to me and before he said a word, he'd go, look left, look right. Hey, Lou. Yeah. And he'd whisper. And everybody was convinced he was doing something. You mean to tell me that you and Taylor are friends?
Oh, we're not friends. We got along in the house, though. Oh, yeah. Okay. I can't stand her, to be honest. And I'll say that on every platform.
That you can say before September 27th. Yeah,
I could stand on that. Yeah. But we got along. We were cordial. And that's what... If you watch live feeds like the day after the argument or whatever, like I went up to her, I was like, hey, you know, that's just not a normal thing. Like you were trying to kick my best friend out of the house, which is against the Big Brother rules. I broke it down for her. I was like, you went against contract. Yeah. I don't know. Let's leave it there. But she went against contract. Yeah. She went against the rules. And she was trying to kick out my best friend and my number one alliance, Nicole, out of the house. And this is when I don't know how much was seen on live feeds, but we all thought Nicole's mom, who was not healthy at the time, was not doing well. And usually if it's life-threatening, you'll be sent home if you want to, of course. And so we all thought Nicole was going home. When Nicole said, no, she's staying, Taylor went in the room. They won't show this part on TV, but like, and told her, well, you should just go home. Like, go be with your mom. Why are you here? Like, when Taylor knew.
I couldn't stand her either.
When Taylor knew that Nicole's my number one. And if you get rid of one of my, you know, allies, now I'm weakened and now you could get me out, which statistically, if you win first HOH of the season, which was me, you would win the game.
Yeah.
And so I think Taylor was smart in the aspect of like, how do I weaken Daniel and get these people out? With that said, I'll try to make it short because I could go on for hours. about day 7 or 8, Taylor said she wants to F Elvis in the house. So if I said that about any girl in the house, I would have been kicked out. Which you should be. But the fact that I went to the diary room and expressed, I don't feel comfortable with that she just said that, like, and I have no interest in her. And they were like, come on, like, don't you want? And I was like, absolutely not. And ever since then, I was aware she actually tried to pick off every girl I was close with, starting with Paloma. And that's a whole nother story.
Yeah.
So Paloma, Amira, Nicole, and then Jasmine, they weren't getting along. And those are all, I was close with all of them. But yeah, so ever since then, we still were cordial even after the argument because you kind of have to be. Like, we live together. You're stuck in a house. You don't see the sun for 5 days at a time. So you're stuck in a room with no windows. And you just kind of have to figure it out. Like, what's the best for us? And even on finale, like, congratulate her and everything. It's like, there's... It's a game. Yeah. I wouldn't hang out with you normally in real life, but like if I saw her, I'd be like, what's up? And like, I just walk by. Like, I'm not taking a photo with you. Like,
And I know you're real close with Terrence. Yeah. So obviously, y'all are close friends. You've got a podcast now. Will that be coming back?
Yeah. So we do, it's called Reality Unhinged, and we do a podcast for Big Brother every season now. And
it's great.
Thank you. This season, we'll have to cover the season. And right after it's over, we're doing, well, it's going to still be on the same podcast, but it's going to be called Big Brother Playback. And we're going to watch every episode of ours that Terrence has never seen. And we're also going to put it on YouTube, and we're going to pause it and talk about everything that happened behind the scenes.
Ooh,
and each episode is going to be a couple hours long for real, because he and I have so much to talk about. And Kyle just moved to Vegas, so we're going to think about bringing him in too. He was part of our season as well.
Oh, cool. I notice sometimes they'll say, they'll actually come over to the speaker and say, stop talking about X.
Oh, yeah.
So I know there's rules, and if they do that, they'll stop you. Because even not during the show, but if people watching the feeds.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you can tell me this or not. It could be argued that they kind of tried to paint you as a villain. Did you like the editing of it? Or did you watch the editing and go, no, that's not accurate at all?
So what's funny is when I first saw it, I was like, oh, what's the problem? This is all true. Like in my storyline. And my friends and family were like, just so you know, this is what people are seeing, because I know the truth in my head. They broke it down. They're like, it looks like you're saying this to her because of this. I'm like, really? And then I rewatched it again. I was like, okay, I can see how this could be misconstrued. But as long as I could express it on podcasts like this or whatever, like, I don't mind. Like, and I always say, hey, just so you know, it is a produced TV show and it's edited. Right. Even the live feeds are edited. It's not 24 hours a day. And we are on a 3-minute delay so that you could take out anything they want. And there's only 2 rooms at a time out of the 14 hotspots in the house, like all this stuff. And so my biggest thing was, I wish I knew I was the villain of the season, because I would have probably put on a little more, because that's like just having brains under me. Yes, because in my head, I'm not joking, I was the hero. Like, I'm not even kidding.
Yeah.
Because I was doing all the right things. I was standing up for my best friends. I was like,
you're a crusader.
Yes. And
really, you're taking on crusades.
Which truly is like a villain storyline. It's like they believed in themselves and that's why they're so evil, like whatever. And I'm like,
what? Now what's crazy is when you see these players that have made it far in the game, like the comic episode or whatever, and they remember day 4, you know, Daniel ate a bowl of cereal and spilled it. I mean, how is that humanly possible? Are you, do they give you an idea? You probably can't tell me that. Are you taking notes throughout the thing, or is it just
this one I could talk about, but like, you're not allowed any pen or pencils, no papers, no music, no TV. Sorry, I should have explained that from the beginning for listeners who don't know the show, but real quick, 16 strangers move into the house. You're locked in from the outside world. No TV, no movies, no music. You can't sing. You can't do anything. It's literally just talking. That's it. And they play 2 songs to wake you up in the morning. They're often the same songs, which is a torture tactic. And sometimes it was Who Let the Dogs Out. I was like, at 10 a.m.? But you lose your mind.
Oh, my God.
But it's all on purpose.
Anything at 10 a.m.
Yeah. And so but yeah, so you can't write down anything. But here's the thing. You're so bored in the house, you go over days. Like, you go, all right, today's day 7. That's when that's when me and Taylor got in the argument. But, like, stuff like that, I was like, all right, if we got in the argument on day 7, that means day 6, Paloma got sent home. Day 5, like, then you start backtracking. And then you go forward. It's like, well, if Amira or whoever won HOH on this day, who went home that week? And that's 4 days later. And like,
wow.
I will say I was in the house for 5 weeks. And even at that point, I couldn't keep track of anything anymore. It was too much going on. So I don't know how, like, when Monty and Taylor got to the end, like, how do you guys even factor half of the season when you're in there for 90 days or whatever, you know?
You know, that happens to POWs, the same thing that you've been through, just with day after day, every day. There's no differentiation between day 1 to day 7 to day 13. It just, you know, you're just in a bubble there, especially with no outside. And I was just no music, no, can't sing, can't, you know, like, wow.
Nothing. Yeah. Yeah. You just wake up and it's silence, which is my hell.
Yeah,
I have to have something on in the background at all times, music, TV, or podcast. And obviously, it's a different mindset. It's like a job where I was like, well, this is what it's going to be, so get used to it. When they do blackouts for sleeping, which is rare, usually the lights are on 24 hours a day. But when they do a full blackout, it's pitch black, which is a fear of mine. So I had to get through a lot of things to, like, figure it out. So it's either pitch black or bright and all this stuff. It's
So Big Brother's no joke. I mean, they really put a lot of thought and effort into the mental aspects to mess with your head.
Yeah, they once I did the research, and this, you can find this anywhere or whatever, in podcasts of past players and stuff like that. But when you really look at it, everything they do is all torture tactic, but it's on the line of making sure it's quote unquote like okay for the for a human to go through or whatever it may be. So we, I think therapeutically, we have to have music in our lives to feel grounded or whatever, but they only play 2 to 3 songs in the morning to make sure, well, all right, we gave them their dose. Now they're done. Yeah. Like, again, they didn't say this to me. This is my research and my understanding of actual like torture tactics and stuff like that. And when I explained to people, the lights wouldn't turn off, but maybe 2 hours a day. And they were bright. Like, I have one ring light on. I'm not kidding. It felt like 20 ring lights on at all times on you.
Wow.
And the reason for that is there's no clock in the house. So it's on a microwave. That's the only one in the house. So you have to go to the kitchen to see it. But I don't think that's a true time. That's just not from, that's not the truth. But my thought is we can't see the sun. So I think I think it's not the real time either. But my point is when they film and edit, they could take what I said last night at 3 a.m. to Monty, and they could use it 3 weeks from today saying this is what happened today. And what it looks like, it's noon because I'm just in the kitchen cooking. But it's 3 a.m. No one knows that unless you watch the live feed. And so it's cool. I actually do like that aspect where it's like, hey, it's editing. It's a story. Like, but that's why the lights are on at all times, except for 2 to 3 hours here and there when it's a full blackout for sleeping. But
yeah. Did you ever have to eat slop?
Yes. Which was a dream come true.
Is it awful?
It's terrible.
Oh yeah. Right. Right.
As a Big Brother fan.
It's like a rite of passage.
So for those of you who don't know, listening, basically there's once a week, or every week there's a slop experience where 4 house guests cannot eat anything but steel cut oats. And that's worse than instant oats, just so everyone's aware. It's not good at all. And you have to actually do a whole process to make it taste decent. But yeah, steel cut oats is your only meal of the day. And we were allowed protein shakes because I think they probably got in trouble and made sure they need some protein. You do that for 7 days and you could only have coffee without creamer and water. And you have to, it's called have nots for the week. And you have to take cold showers. You can never get in warm showers or else you could get a vote against you to be sent home. So pretty much you're at the bottom of the totem pole for the week. What's crazy is I won the first HOH, which is my dream, my number one to do.
Yeah.
After 7 days of being king of the house. So HOH is basically you could vote people out, whatever. 7 days later, I'm on slop. So I went from the top to the bottom. And the best diet, though, I've ever experienced. I saw a 4-pack for the first time in like 15 years on my stomach. And after that, you on day 4 of slop, you do start losing your mind a little bit. And I think that's part of the process. They want you to go crazy.
Wow.
And I remember day 4, I had to tell everybody, hey, I'm not talking today because like whatever I say is going to sound rude. I'm not feeling it today. And then once you get past that, it's crazy. But I'm glad I got to experience it as a fan.
Well, I got one more Big Brother question. Then I want to talk to you a minute about getting back to the Westgate, sharing experience I had with you. But do you think it would the opportunity ever be there for you to come back on Big Brother like they'll bring people back? Would that ever happen?
I think CBS is afraid to bring me back because of the backlash that happened that was made up online. And so
– right.
Not that they know the truth. They know they love me. Like my exit interview was amazing. They're all about it, but they know what it looks like to the outside. So they're like, we're good. But I was always hoping for a villain season. They've never done that in their lives, like in the history of Big Brother.
Be great.
So at least then there's like, you know, it's anything goes. So bring back every villain possible. Even like Evil Dick when he's very much canceled, but bring him back. Like that's part of it, you know?
Right.
But so I don't know. I always thought if they ever leave CBS and just go strictly to Paramount streaming, then I think I'll be welcome back. Because when it's just streaming, you're making the choice to click, yes, I want to watch this. When it's on TV, it's kind of forced at sometimes whoever's watching it live on TV. So I think CBS is just covering themselves.
It's that pesky FCC that covers on air stuff. Yeah.
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 But we'll see. I would do it in a heartbeat though. I even though it was a mental torture, I would jump right back on.
Well, Tom and I always talk about this podcast with Alex here. We talk about a lot of things. We've interviewed, you know, we got one coming up with Wink Martindale.
Cool.
You know, just a bunch of fascinating people. We talk about Burt Reynolds. We're big Burt Reynolds fans, and John Wayne. But I don't think anybody ever saw us talking about Big Brother this much, but I'm glad we did because I love the show. And I actually lied to you. I have met you before, and I remember where now. I was in Las Vegas watching.
Oh,
I can't remember.
Legends of the Concert back in the building.
And they kept referring to me as Big Lou. Yeah. And it was Bill and Jerry and Vic and Pat Dunn. And I saw you sitting there and I went up and introduced myself. And guys, I mean, I'm 6'2". And I was looking up. I was surprised at how tall you were, you know. But you said, I can't believe I'm meeting Big Lou, because it was kind of a joke that night. They're making a big deal that I was some celebrity there. You know, it's funny. But I've been very fortunate. I've sang all over the world. I've been fortunate enough to sing at the Grand Ole Opry.
Wow.
I got to sing at the Ryman. And I got to sing and emcee a show on the stage at the Westgate. The Ryman probably took number one, but boy, Westgate, that's just right there with it. And it was so cool. Have you gone up and down the elevator 1,000 times yet?
Yeah. So real quick, my show is at the Cabaret, which is 50 feet away from it.
Yeah. Gotcha.
And so
yeah.
You'll see, which if you haven't been in that theater, I think it's like 250 seats. It has a balcony. It's
great theater.
It's intimate, but it's oddly like epic at the same time. I don't know.
Yeah.
But what we do is after the show, we do a VIP tour after every single show. I host it in the jumpsuit and everything. So it's like within 10 minutes after the show. And so it's an add-on if you buy a ticket to the show type of thing. I'm sure when you guys come, I could get the hookup. You know what I'm saying? But
all right,
we'll do the tour. You'll probably know more than me about the international, but I'll be like, go ahead, take it away. So we do groups from 5 to 10 or so per group. And we do the whole tour of the international. It's about 15 to 20 minute tour. Walking the theater up front, then we go to the dressing room downstairs and we retrace Elvis's steps, point out the water fountain that he would drink up before going up the elevator. So my favorite part is that elevator still smells like it's from the 60s, 70s, and like it's old smell.
You smell the smoke, can't you?
It smells like my grandma's house. Like, really, I was like, this is amazing. How do they do it?
It's crazy. And I remember the dumbest thing I ever said. I was backstage and they'd set up a little side. They called it Big Lou's Bungalow. And I was very fortunate. Linda Thompson was there, and we talked, me and Bill and her friend, probably talked 2 hours back there. And finally she goes, now, how do I get out of here? Do I go this way or this way? I go, we got to go that way. And she kind of rolled her eyes. I went, oh, yeah, you've been back here a few times, haven't you? But I tell you something weird to do, and I'm anxious to see if – I'm not a ghost believer, none of that.
Yeah.
But I was standing in front of the elevator, and, man, my stomach started bothering me. And, you know, it's Vegas. And I thought, man, I'm – kind of dehydrated stomach hurting, right? So I went and grabbed me a bottle of water and I drank it. All right, yeah, I'm fine. I went back and I stood in front of the elevator again. I was just nauseous, kind of, what in the world? And I thought, there's some gas, blow, whatever. I step away from it. Swear to God, this is true. And it was fine. So there was a girl, Rosa, came around the corner. I said, do me a favor, stand right in front of that elevator. And she did. And all of a sudden, she looked at me with this scowl. Oh, my God, my stomach.
Wow.
12 more people stood in front of that elevator. So one of two things, Elvis isn't happy about Barry being there, Manilow, or there's some gas coming out of the elevator making us all sick. I don't know which, but it was the straight. You walk away and you're fine. Stand in front of it. And it so I'm anxious to see. And they'll go, what the heck's he doing in front of the elevator? But
yeah, because I've only walked by it or through it. But yeah, maybe I'll just stand there for a second.
It's a weird feeling.
That's amazing.
And it's so cool. Anybody that's had the opportunity, it never gets old being behind that stage and just thinking of Elvis, that great video of him walking on stage with all the guys around him and just thinking, man, it was right here.
Yeah, I'm still at that space where I'm just like, this is unreal. Like, to me, that shot, and that's the way it is, of walking with the scrim right behind him, that's the greatest shot ever. And that's, like, to me, his prime that he's ever been. And everything about it is special. And so it's cool that I get to kind of host it because I'm like, wait, I'm here every day now. Like, this is unreal to me. And like right after the show, and I'm sure for the fans experiencing it with the guy who just, you know, was the Elvis tribute on stage, I'm sure that's a layer of like, wait, what is our lives? Like, I've seen online already like photos of just me like talking, but to them it's like me on stage in the jumpsuit from a distance. So it looks kind of like Elvis up there. And yeah, it's super cool, and I hope that never goes away, understanding like how special it is for even guests to come to the it's VIP great. Experience.
Well, I'm going to do one more thing and hand it over to Thomas. Got one little shout out. Phil James, he was a fraternity brother of mine, one of my best friends in college. He's the president of the union.
Oh, cool.
And that's under his, the lights.
Oh, nice.
People and all that. So if you ever get a chance to meet him, he usually comes by there and checks on him. But be sure and give Phil a shout out. And I'll hand it over to Tom. Daniel, just say before I give it over to Tom, man, this was great.
Thank you.
I've been excited to have you on. I think you're an interesting guy. I think the story is interesting. And the more I've learned about you, just a fascinating life. And congratulations on the show. I know it's a dream of all the ETAs out there to have that opportunity. So congratulations.
Thank you. I appreciate
it. I'm just so happy that someone that understands it, that respects it, that loves Elvis as much as you do, has that opportunity, because it could go to a lot of people that wouldn't quite get it the way that you've gotten it. And I want to thank you for the Big Brother info, because like I said before, you know, I hadn't watched the show and I didn't know a lot about it, but you've made it. Strangely, I want to see your season now. I really want to sit down. I want to get to know great. You in that. And I'm always fascinated. I was in TV production for a long time, and I know how they take things and move them around. And you're just doing the best you can. And man, just the story of just what it takes to do that show, I think, is something that shows your love of, you know what, this is my gig. I'm going to do that. That's what I find so admirable about it. You know, a friend of mine who did a show on Broadway for 2 years, he said, the best thing is I'm on Broadway and the worst thing is I'm on Broadway, because he's on Broadway, but he's got to grind 8 shows a week out and he's got to do it. And when everything that happens between 7 and 11 o'clock is timed to the minute and it has to be exactly the same every night. And then the next day he gets up and he knows all day long he's got to do that again at the end of the night. He's got to do it all over again. You stand, you know, the great thing is you do a great show. Great. It lasts tonight. Now you got to do another one tomorrow. And I'm glad somebody, a theater person, because I'm a theater person too. I'm glad one of us has been handed the reins there at the Westgate. So I'm glad it's you, my friend.
Wow, that's special. I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Why don't you give us the information on it for everybody that wants to go see it?
Yeah, we've got new fans here.
All right, so it's at the Westgate in Las Vegas, Tuesday, Wednesdays, Thursdays for now. Hopefully, we'll move into the weekend soon. but it's cool because it's the summer, so at least people are still vacationing and stuff like that. Tuesdays at 5:30 is the show, so obviously it opens 30 minutes before. Wednesdays and Thursdays are 7:30. There's a VIP tour after every show. You just have to add it on before the show starts. It could be the day of. And yeah, it's about an 80-minute or so show. We go through all the eras, 26 songs. And I play. I don't want to give too much away of the show, but come and see it. I really enjoy doing it.
Jeff, he's a man of mystery, isn't he? He's just a man of mystery.
That's right.
You got to leave him something to come see, you know. But yeah, so, and hopefully, I'm sure for a month or so, the schedule will stay the same, but we're hoping, you know, we just got to get the word out and tickets to sell to prove, well, let's move into the weekend. And they have other shows there, which are great. I've seen them and they're amazing. But so we're sharing a venue with 2 other shows. But yeah, so come check it out. We're here till, as of right now, till I want to say mid to late September. Mm-hmm. Obviously, if things work out, hopefully it extends and all that. But all we know is limited for now. And, hopefully the word spreads and we won't ever leave.
All right.
Well, Tom, I don't know if you ever saw Daniel in his full regalia when you met him, if he was all done up. The transformation that you do with your makeup and it is fascinating.
Thank you.
I mean, when I saw a picture of you as Elvis, I was like, well, that's not Daniel.
Wow, thanks.
It was really, really great job on that,
it's
too.
It's a swift 3 hours, so I appreciate it.
You picked a fun career, yeah, didn't you? You picked a really fun career.
I know. It, oddly enough, it might be my favorite part is getting ready. That's such a theater kid. Like, you know.
Great to have you on the show. And the King comes home at the Westgate with our friend Daniel Durston. And like you said, we want this show to go. Elvis fans, let's support Daniel. Go see The King Comes Home at the Westgate. It's up to
spread the word.
You got Elvis fans coming into Vegas every day. If it's not you, it's somebody you know. Let's get the word out.
Hey, you know, real quick, a shout out to Pink Cadillacs podcast. Apparently, Sky happened to be in Vegas visiting the Westgate, and they were like, "Well, they're doing their first run through right before they open the show, if you want to go see. So I listened to Pink Cadillac's podcast, and like, I learned later from our PR guy, he was like, oh, by the way, I don't know if you know Sky from Pink Cadillac. She was here. I was like, I'm a fan. Like,
oh, that's so great.
I wrote them. I was like, you should have told me it was you, because I said hi, but I was in the stress mode of I got a show to run or whatever. Yeah. But it was super cool to like see them there as well. But anyway, shout out to their podcast who cover Elvis as well.
And they're a little more advanced than us with technology. They do the cool TikTok stuff and all that. But we're talking to them right now about doing something, making a fool out of me and Tom on TikTok, and they can they'll be the good looking ones, and we'll be the goofy old man on it. So we'll see. Yeah,
it's going to be a whole lot easier than they think it is to make us look stupid.
Well, let me know. Either of you come to Vegas, please let me know, and we'll make sure you're on the guest list, and we'll do it all.
Oh, it'll hit the press when we make it to Vegas. Trust me.
I'm sure. Yeah, I'll hear it before you even tell me.
Yeah. Man, thank you, Daniel. Oh my gosh, so glad you were able to do this with us.
Me too. Thanks for having me.
Well, Jeff, we have been in Las Vegas for the last little while. We started out with John Daly from the Elvis Presley Boulevard Pawn Shop, giving us a history of the International Hilton Westgate. And we also had Daniel Durston, who's appearing there at the hotel in his Elvis show. So I think the only way we can top this is, Alex, Jeff, we're going to Vegas, baby.
Let's do it. I'm ready.
All right. All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening to this very special edition, Las Vegas style, of the Tupelo Tom and Big Lou Talkin'. We'll be back with a regularly scheduled episode in the near future. We invite you to go back and click on some of the episodes you might have missed. We have a lot of cool guest stars, a lot of cool stories. And listen, we're talking about Elvis. So you listen to him over and over, just like Hound Dog and Suspicious Minds, right?
That's right.
All right. I'm Tupelo Tom.
And I'm Big Lou.
And we're done talking.